Hello everybody and welcome. My name's Claire Farrell. I'm one of the co-founders of Extinction Rebellion.
And I'm Dr. Charlie Gardner. I'm a conservation scientist and I'm with Scientists for Extinction Rebellion. So welcome back to episode 4 of The World in Flux, where we try and talk about recent issues in the climate space, news and new science that we don't feel are getting enough attention. But before we do that, what have you been up to recently, Claire?
Recently, I was lucky enough that a friend of mine introduced me to somebody called Peter Jukes, who works for the Byline Times, founded it. As an expert in the field of understanding what these what the think tanks do, a lot of what we talked about was digging into the tactics, what they're doing, how that affects politics, how it distorts the discourse. But there was one thing that I learned from it, which I had never heard before. Mm-hmm. And at the moment, I feel like there keeps on being these small bits of information that sort of appear and I go, oh my God, it's so much worse than I originally thought. The thing that he told me that I'd never heard before was that in some of the networked think tanks, you can pay for death threats.
No. Seriously?
Yeah.
What the fuck? Wow.
So I will try and find some information about that to add into the detailed description of this episode. But it's, you know, shocking and sort of unsurprising at the same time, you know, in a sort of in a very heartbreaking way.
Yeah, constantly having to, you know, readjust my expectations and my very my understanding of what are the worst things that people can do. Yeah, the more you hear about these efforts on the way to stop us transitioning to a post-carbon future, it's constantly shocking the levels to which people will stoop. I think it's often quite hard for sort of empathetic people to understand. I think lots of people in the climate movement are people that are naturally caring, naturally empathetic, and often look to the best in people, always have trust that people are doing things for the right motives and things, and it's difficult to understand that there are people that don't have that empathy and don't have that sense of duty of care and are prepared to literally fuck everyone over and just do these awful things in order to achieve their personal aims or just because they're being paid to do it. But yeah, I'm constantly shocked actually by just how far people will go to continue pumping oil for just a few more years. It's really amazing.
Yeah, I mean it's in the sort of dedicated service of capital, isn't it? And the dedicated service to neoliberal ideologies, I guess. You know, what we'll talk about today is a little bit on think tanks and the ad industry. I looked up this article that came out a little while ago in the New Republic, which is Meet the Shadowy Global Network Vilifying Climate Protesters. It's really interesting because it's a focus on what we've come up in conversations before about how certain people, certain organisations have pushed an agenda that leads to the destruction of the right to protest, legislation that is designed to undermine peaceful protest, non-violence, but also in particular what this article points out, which I had never heard before, was that there was 500 think tanks in a network that are all connected through a thing called the Atlas Group. And it's struck me that the idea that these people are not just mimicking each other's work in different places, in different continents, but perhaps even collaborating. Similar laws are being pushed in parts of Australia that undermine the right to protest. Similar narratives are going out in the media in Germany around activists. They're using the same stories to undermine them. They've got these connections all over South America, North America, Central America, Europe. When you've dug a little bit around Tufton Street and thinking about what happens in the UK, if you imagine that on a 500-strong global network, I mean, that's quite a that's quite a lot more collateral that they've got on their side than I realised.
It's a lot of power. You mentioned Tufton Street. Well, Tufton Street's right at the heart of it. Tufton Street is the home of the IEA, the Institute of Economic Affairs, and it was the IEA that started this whole Atlas network. The founder who founded the IEA then went on to found think tanks in all these other countries and bring them together in this network. It was a fantastic piece, by the way. Amy Vestervelt, she's such a brilliant climate reporter and really good. There aren't that many investigative journalists looking at the climate space, but Amy Vestervelt's amazing. So one implication of this, hearing about these 500 coordinated think tanks is like, wow, they're a lot more powerful than we think. It's not just here. But the thing that really struck me about hearing that they're all coordinated is it makes you think how widespread this neoliberal fundamentalist ideology is. Because when you think, if you hear that there are 500 think tanks in every different country, there are neoliberal think tanks pushing for this, you think, oh, wow. Well, people in all these different countries have all come up with this same idea of fundamental liberalism and they're all pushing for it. It's quite a widespread idea. Lots of people in different places all share this goal. But when you hear that they actually, they didn't organically sprout up in all these different places. They were created in all these different places by the IEA and the centre of this Atlas network. Partly it exposes the lie that people everywhere want fundamentalism. It's not. It's the same donors pushing it everywhere. But it comes back to what we were talking about in our last episode about sovereignty, when we were talking about how think tanks like Policy Exchange and the IEA in the UK are funded by dark money, and what funders can be traced come from the US. So you have US oligarch interests influencing policy in the UK. And now you hear about the Atlas Network, and it's the same people funding it, as far as we know. So they're not just trying to influence policy in the UK, they're trying to influence policy in every country where there is one of these networks. It really raises a lot of questions about democracy and sovereignty if independent national policies aren't actually independent at all. They're all being pushed in the same direction from the same small number of dark money funders. It's really worrying stuff. And of course, it's crazy that there's just this one article about it. If we had a healthy, functioning media ecosystem, then as soon as Amy's article came out, every other media corporation around the place should have been going, we need to expose this. This is a massive fucking story and we need to dig into this and expose it. And of course, that didn't happen.
And repeatedly you see on the mainstream news, particularly, I find it sometimes quite shocking how much attention these people can get through going on things on the BBC, for example. But they will bring on someone who's a member of the Institute for Economic Affairs as if they are an independent economic expert.
They'll just label them political commentator or something like that and not say who they actually work for. It's a joke.
The other thing that I think this piece is super focused on, though, is really about how they want to rebrand activists as criminal organisations to encourage the police to treat them more harshly, to encourage the court system to treat them more severely. And this is something that they're looking at Last Generation in Germany in reference to the way that they're being treated by the media. The use of words like terrorist, extremist, dangerous, radical. I mean, it's pretty difficult, isn't it, when you think those words are actually appropriate for use against the leaders of our countries. And that's obviously what Antonio Guterres has said a long time ago now. People who want to pursue fossil fuels are dangerous radicals. Do we get anywhere by just also using those words? I don't know. It feels quite difficult, doesn't it? Peter said to me the other day, when they go low, you get to go high because you are on the higher ground, because you are interested in truth and justice and peace and humanity, you know, so you don't have to fight them in the gutter. But I do think it's important, right, to understand how they operate and to try and expose more of what they are doing and the ways that they're doing it. I guess the other thing I wanted to mention on this front was about how the new energy minister, Cortino, she used to be a policy exchange fellow and has put together international energy policy work in the past with Scott Morrison, the former Premier of Australia, who everybody knows is a joker when it comes to climate, walked into their parliament with a piece of coal, laughing about it. Look, it's harmless. All of that. And so, you know, there's that side of things where you know that the politicians then that are climate delayers, climate deniers, they're working in a networked way to think about policy through these things. And in addition to that as well, you have what I think is an extraordinary moment with the RSPB a little while ago where they were, you know, the nature charities are gagged in this country because of the gagging laws, so the whole charity sector is. But being totally exasperated with the nature policies and the rollback on like environmental protections, they tweeted out, you know, these ministers are liars, this one's a liar, that one's a liar, that one's a liar, and all these things they said that they would do, they've rolled back on and they're liars. Then what happened?
So they put out this tweet and everyone was celebrating it. Finally, someone is, you know, sticking up for nature in this country. Then a couple of hours later, they sent an apology round saying, oh, we didn't mean to speak so harshly or whatever. They didn't delete the tweet, but they made this apology. So immediately people start thinking, yeah, why this quick U-turn? It turns out that one of the trustees of the RSPB immediately tweeted saying, this is ridiculous, you know, NGOs shouldn't be speaking this way about government ministers, you need to be polite and all of this. I'm going to raise it with the Board of Trustees. But then we look at this trustee. He's a guy called Ben Caldicott. Where does he come from? He comes from this think tank sector. He was employed by, or may even still be connected to, one of these think tanks. I can't remember precisely.
Policy Exchange.
It was Policy Exchange, of course.
And Policy Exchange, not mentioned on the RSPB website, not mentioned where he's profiled in association with the NGO sector, no mention of Policy Exchange. But if you look him up, then he is.
Yep.
So okay. It seems a strategic placement of people on boards of non-government organisations and stuff is a very smart thing to do, isn't it?
Yeah, and of course there's been quite a high profile coverage of their attempts to do the same with the National Trust. There's this group of think tank people basically got a campaign called Restore Trust, and they're trying to get all these people elected onto the Board of Trustees. But because it's been quite well publicised, all the National Trust members have seen through it, and they've never managed to get elected so far. But yeah, the same thing has obviously happened with other NGOs without the exposure. So I think, you know, we need to shine a light on this. We need a campaign, Restore Trust in Trustees, and kick these people out of these organisations. But one some very interesting follow-up from that is the Charity Commission have come out and said, actually, charities can be political, and they can say harsh politically stuff. And that's come out quite recently. So I hope that will empower the NGOs. By the time this episode comes out, this story will have progressed a lot, actually, because on 28th September, Chris Packham and lots of other groups are coming together at Parliament. It's the release of the State of Nature report, which is this periodic report about the state of nature in the UK. obviously, you know, we don't have to see a leak of the report to know what it's going to say. It's going to say that nature in this country is, you know, getting worse and worse and worse, and it's happening really fast. From what I've heard, lots of the wildlife conservation charities are coming out and joining us on the streets that day. So that should be really exciting. And we'll report back on that in a future episode. But I think it is really, really important that this sector does stand up against the government, because when it comes to nature, the government is basically trying to undo all the work that these charities have done over the last few decades. They worked really, really hard to get important pieces of legislation established, and now the government wants to undo this and take us backwards. They tried recently with the net neutrality legislation, which basically said that housing developers don't have to be responsible for their pollution of rivers and stuff. And this was the first time in decades that we've actually rolled back, or the government has tried to roll back existing environmental legislation. But now that we've left the EU, lots of our environmental laws stem from our time in the EU, and they're European laws, not domestic ones. The big, big concern for nature lovers, and well, for everybody in this country really, is the attempt to basically lose all these EU era pieces of environmental legislation and not replace them with equivalents, which will leave us in a situation where we did have this big legislative framework that limited what corporations and others could do, and now we just won't have this legislative framework anymore. So, and you know, it'll be a real worry what happens if that comes to pass. So I think it's really important that that the NGOs stand up. Of course, they have. There are reasons why they are reluctant to stand up against the government, but that's where we, as members of these organisations, have a lot of influence. I know lots of people in Extinction Rebellion are also members of the National Trust and the RSPB and the Wildlife Trust and stuff. And lots of us now are putting pressure on them as members and saying, you know, as your membership, we would really like you to, you know, get political and do more, because this is an emergency and someone needs to stand up for nature in this country. So I'm hoping we'll see a lot more action in this space, wildlife conservation sector coming together with environmental activists more and more, and we'll report back on that as it happens.
Well, I mean, it's true, I think, that, you know, the Brexit sort of phenomenon was actually supported and pushed by people who wanted these rollbacks. They wanted to lower the threshold of how much, you know, how much you can get away with in terms of environmental damage, in terms of pollution, in terms of the way that we treat workers. It feels very clear to me that it's a liberalising agenda that pushed that so hard. And it was notable, wasn't it, that when they did that rollback on the neutrality regs, the share prices of the two biggest home building companies in the country went up. It just all feels so blatant at the moment, and it's not... You know, I guess in a way, what I want to say, if anyone who's like senior in any of these NGOs is watching, is like, we've been trying to have this conversation for a long time about how political this is and how your life and death reality that you're standing in as a citizen is a highly political one. And so, you know, any opportunity that we've got to work out how to, you know, bring more people with us, bring more membership out, bring more people to do more radical things in the name of their campaigning and their taking direct action and stuff like that. That, you know, it feels so important to keep on saying, the door's always open, please join us, please come. The big one was an enormous effort to get people to show up to something. And it was basically marching and standing around in Westminster with permission. And I really wish that we could take those people on a journey to sit somewhere without permission, you know?
It will happen, I think. You know, things, of course, escalate in time. As the situation gets more and more desperate and more people wake up to that, then, of course, your tactics will continue to diversify and evolve, and more and more people will become involved. I think, yeah, fundamentally, we need to remember, as conservationists and as people that work in the wildlife conservation sector, what we're fundamentally about. And, you know, we're about protecting nature. We're not about building memberships or being visible or, you know, having cozy relationships with ministers. If the stuff we've been doing hasn't worked, then we need to try something else. And the mm-hmm. fact is, you know, whilst the conservation sector has, you know, made tremendous advances in the UK, and, you know, our knowledge base is amazing. We know exactly what needs to be done. We know how to manage ecosystems. We know how to save endangered species. We know how to catch fish sustainably. We know how to do all these things, but we're not doing them. And despite all the progress we've made in conservation over the last few decades, we're losing nature faster than ever.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we know how to do it, but it's not being done.
Just on that, I think what's really important is also to look at the ad industry. So the tied with the think tank space and the dark lobbying space, there's also these like big relationships between different companies and the PR industry. And there's an enormous advertising and communications company called Edelman. And a woman who I noticed a few years ago, Christina Rina, who used to work there, who sort of famously quit and was like, I can't be part of this. It's disgusting. And a lot of these companies, they've done amazing work for the greenwashing of fossil fuel companies, for example, like massive amounts of money have exchanged hands. I think actually somebody did some direct action at Edelman some time ago with Extinction Rebellion. But the article that came out in DSmog, the focus is on the support that Edelman have been giving for quite a long time now to this guy, Sultan Ahmed Al-Jaber, who is the dude who's heading up the COP this year. They found that for an extremely long time, so since 2007, Edelman have been carrying out campaigns with him and the United Arab Emirates to the tune of millions and millions of dollars in order to generate a green public image for the government and for particularly this person, all trading a lot on this place called Masdar City, which is supposed to be like a zero carbon sort of utopian uh-huh. metropolis that they're developing. So aside from the, you know, the deep, deep fossil fuel and oil interests that are there, and the fact that, what is he? The head of an oil company.
He's CEO of an oil company. He's the CEO of an oil company who is in charge of global climate negotiations.
Yeah.
Can you imagine anything
and
more corrupt?
You may think then that the international negotiation process called COP has reached peak bullshit. Do you know what I mean? And here we find that actually decades of PR work have been put in to buy a massive advertising firm to try and create a kind of generous image. The images in this article that go back to George Bush era and showing them being photographed together and talking about how, you know, it's going to be this green oasis in a red land of desert or whatever. I mean, all of this sort of, it's just mad, isn't it? And so it just doesn't feel responsible anymore, does it, to like promote COP? I mean, Bill Maguire, climate scientist on Twitter a little while ago, saying people should just boycott it now. It's too fucking much. No, you know.
It's difficult, isn't it? Because, you know, we do need global cooperation on
yeah.
this. And we need some way for the countries of the world to get together and decide on things collectively. And, you know, it's the COP process that does that. But when it's headed by an oil company, obviously it's completely, completely discredited. And one has to wonder if that's, you know, partially the aim. Obviously the direct aim of getting fossil fuel interests deep within the heart of COP is to, you know, stop them making decisions that will hamper fossil fuel interests. But you wonder if a secondary aim is to actually discredit the process. Mm. If nobody has any faith in COP anymore, then obviously there's not going to be any...
Just to make it impossible to even have an international negotiation, you mean?
Yeah, yeah.
That's frightening, isn't it, if some people are acting with that purpose in mind. It's so cynical, I guess, and it also, you know, it speaks back to what's in the kind of opening segment of that piece we were talking about earlier, looking at the Atlas think tank network, because it sounds like the guy who started the IEA considered going into politics and was told on good advice, that's a mug's game.
There's a much more effective way to influence policy.
Control the ideas. Yeah. Don't go and like dick around in politics. It's a waste of time. So, I mean, it's not beyond the realms of possibility, is it, that there is a wider strategy to just say, let's make it impossible for there to be a credible international conversation. Yeah. And then, hey, there won't be one. We can just get on with it.
Imagine the levels of cynicism and planning that led to this point where the CEO of an oil firm is in charge of climate negotiations. Mm. Yeah, there's a lot of work that goes into making that happen. Mm. So I wouldn't put anything past these nefarious actors because, they're prepared to risk the lives of everyone, and they're prepared to risk everything we have and everything we love for their own private gain. And I wouldn't put anything beyond them at all. If I could just finish with one little point about this idea of that we are extreme or radical or anything like that. This accusation is about our tactics and not our demands, right? People might think blocking a road is extreme. People might think throwing, soup at a work of art is extreme. And, everyone has different opinions on what is an acceptable form of protest. But the core demand of moving away from fossil fuels as rapidly as we can, the core demand of maintaining a safe, livable space for humanity, there's nothing radical about that at all. It's something that we can all agree on. And just something to think about when we're accused of being radical. We're not. Our position is the most middle of the road, conservative position that you could possibly adopt. All we're trying to do is not lose everything we have. Mm. And there's nothing radical about that whatsoever.
Well, that's a fine point to end on. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Claire. That was wonderful. Lovely to speak to you, as always. Join us again for another episode very soon. Thank you.